A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the two temples that stood in Jerusalem, the first and the second, and how they stack up against each other. Construction methods, sheer physical grandeur, why one lasted nearly 6 centuries and the other didn't. And then the part that really caught my eye, what role did these places actually give to non-Jews in the ancient world? Because the modern assumption is that the temple was this walled-off, exclusively Jewish space. The archaeology tells a very different story.
It does, and it's one of those cases where what people picture in their heads and what the historical record shows are almost completely different buildings. The second temple, especially after Herod got his hands on it, was one of the largest religious structures in the ancient world, and it had a dedicated outer courtyard explicitly designed for non-Jews. That's not a footnote. That's the design philosophy.
A courtyard for everyone else, right at the threshold of the sacred. That's bold.
It's what makes this whole comparison worth doing. Before we get into the engineering, we need to understand what we're actually comparing. Let's set the timeline.
We've got two distinct building projects separated by about 4 centuries and a catastrophic destruction. The first temple, Solomon's Temple. Built around 957 BCE, destroyed in 587 or 586 BCE by the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar II. It stood for roughly 370 years.
Then, after the Babylonian exile, the second temple goes up around 516 BCE. Modest at first, nothing like what it would become. Then Herod the Great starts his massive expansion in 20 BCE, and that project runs for 46 years. The whole complex is destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE. Total lifespan for the Second Temple period, about 586 years, including that 70-year gap.
The Second Temple outlasted the first by more than 2 centuries. That's already telling us something about the engineering.
It's telling us everything about the engineering. So let's start with the original. Solomon's Temple. What do we actually know about it, and what's been mythologized?
I feel like most people's mental image of the first temple is basically the second temple, but earlier. Gold everywhere, massive scale, visible from miles away.
That's wrong on almost every count. Let me give you the actual dimensions from 1 Kings chapter 6. The building itself was about 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. In modern terms, that's roughly 90 feet by 30 feet by 45 feet. For a religious structure, that's not nothing, but it's not enormous.
That's smaller than a modern basketball court. An NBA court is 94 feet by 50 feet. So the entire first temple would fit inside a basketball arena with room to spare for the concession stands.
Think about what that means for the scale of ritual activity. We're talking about a building where maybe a few dozen priests could operate at any given time. It wasn't designed for crowds. It was designed for a specialized priesthood serving a relatively small population, and the construction was heavily dependent on Phoenician collaboration. Hiram of Tyre, sometimes spelled Huram, provided cedar from Lebanon and skilled craftsmen. The Bible emphasizes that the stone was quarried off-site, finished at the quarry so that no hammer or chisel or any iron tool was heard at the temple site while it was being built. That's a beautiful detail. Silent construction. But it also tells you this wasn't a project that could draw on a massive local industrial base. They needed imported expertise.
Which makes sense. The United Monarchy under Solomon was a regional power, but it wasn't Egypt, it wasn't Assyria, it wasn't fielding thousands of trained stoneworkers. You're basically hiring the Phoenicians as architectural consultants and general contractors.
And here's the thing about the first temple that most coverage misses. We have zero contemporary non-biblical descriptions of it. Everything we know comes from the biblical text and from comparative archaeology of other Near Eastern temples from the same period. When you look at what the Egyptians were building at Karnak, the Temple of Amun there was begun around 2000 BCE and was continuously expanded for 2000 years. Solomon's temple was modest by comparison. The hypostyle hall at Karnak alone covers 54,000 square feet. That's one room larger than the entire Temple Mount platform of the First Temple period.
The reputation comes entirely from religious significance, not architectural achievement.
That's the core of it. The Bible describes gold overlay on the interior, cherubim carved from olive wood and covered in gold, the Holy of Holies housing the Ark of the Covenant. That's symbolically enormous. But physically, this was not a wonder of the ancient world. It was a well-made regional shrine. To put it in perspective, the Parthenon in Athens, built about 5 centuries later, used roughly 30,000 tons of marble. Solomon's temple probably used a fraction of that in local limestone, with cedar beams and gold leaf.
It didn't even last 4 centuries. What went wrong?
First, the foundation engineering. The first temple was built on a relatively unstable section of the eastern hill, what's now called the City of David area. They didn't have the techniques or the ambition to create the kind of massive artificial platform that would define the second temple. So you've got a structure sitting on uneven bedrock with fill material underneath, and over centuries that settles and shifts. Imagine building a house on a slope with packed dirt instead of digging down to solid rock and pouring a proper foundation. Sooner or later, the walls start cracking.
The second thing?
When Nebuchadnezzar II decided to make an example of rebellious Judah, he didn't just occupy the city, he systematically demolished the temple. The Babylonians were thorough. They stripped everything of value and then tore the structure down. It wasn't an accidental fire, it was a deliberate erasure. And here's what's interesting. The Babylonians had a policy with conquered peoples. They didn't just destroy for destruction's sake. They wanted to demonstrate that the local god had been defeated by Marduk, the Babylonian patron deity. So destroying the temple was a theological statement as much as a military one.
The first temple was a modest building with a legendary reputation, built on shaky ground, destroyed by an empire that wanted to make a theological point. Now contrast that with Herod's project.
If the first temple was a modest regional shrine, the second temple was a statement of imperial ambition. And this is where the numbers get genuinely staggering. Herod didn't just renovate the existing structure, he doubled the size of the Temple Mount platform to 36 acres. That's 144,000 square meters.
36 acres. Put that in perspective for me.
It's still one of the largest man-made religious platforms in the world, comparable to the base of the Great Pyramid of Giza. To give you a concrete comparison, the entire Roman Forum, the political and religious heart of Rome itself, covers about 12 acres. Herod's temple platform was 3 times that size. And he achieved this by building massive retaining walls around the existing hill, filling the space between with earth and rubble, and then constructing the temple and its courtyards on top of this artificial esplanade. The engineering is Roman-level sophisticated.
Those retaining walls are what we're still looking at today.
That's the key misconception to bust right there. The western wall, the Kotel, is not a remnant of the temple building itself. It's a section of the retaining wall that held up the platform. The actual temple sanctuary was destroyed by the Romans in 70 CE, but the retaining walls were so massive that dismantling them was essentially impossible with the technology of the time.
They survived by being too big to break.
Let me give you a number. The largest stone in the western wall is called the Master Course Stone. It's estimated to weigh approximately 517 tons. A fully loaded Boeing 747 weighs about 440 tons. This single stone is heavier than a jumbo jet.
How do you even move a 500-ton stone in 20 BCE?
That's a whole episode on its own, and we actually touched on ancient megastructure engineering in an earlier episode about moving massive stones. But the short version is, teams of oxen, wooden rollers, and probably some kind of ramp or lever system that we still don't fully understand. These stones were quarried about 4 kilometers away, near what's now the Ramat Shlomo neighborhood. The logistics are mind-bending. And here's a detail that I love. Archaeologists have actually found one of these stones abandoned in the quarry, partially cut but never moved. It's even larger than the Master Course Stone, estimated at around 570 tons. They probably realized they couldn't transport it and just left it there.
There's a 570-ton oops sitting in a Jerusalem quarry.
The world's most expensive abandoned project. And the stones they did move are cut so precisely that you can't slide a piece of paper between them.
No mortar at all?
Interlocking ashlar blocks cut to fit perfectly. and they're set directly into bedrock. That's why the retaining walls have survived 2,000 years of seismic activity. This is earthquake country, and they're still standing. The Jordan Rift Valley is part of the Great Rift System that runs all the way down to Mozambique. Jerusalem has experienced major earthquakes roughly every 80 to 100 years throughout recorded history. The Herodian engineers understood load distribution and foundation anchoring at a level that wouldn't be matched for centuries. They essentially created a structure that can sway slightly during seismic events without collapsing.
The durability difference isn't even close. The first temple lasted 370 years on shaky fill. The second temple's foundations are still standing after two millennia. What about the building itself? What did the actual temple look like at its peak?
This is where Josephus becomes our primary source, and he does not hold back. He describes the facade as being covered in gold plates that dazzled the eyes of spectators, his phrase. He says that from a distance it looked like a mountain of snow, because of the white marble and limestone, but up close the gold reflected the rising sun so intensely that you literally had to look away.
The ancient equivalent of a building that blinds you with its shine.
Practical, in a weird way. The Mishnah, in the tractate Midot, mentions that the temple roof had gold-tipped spikes to prevent birds from perching. You've got this gleaming gold facade, and you don't want birds nesting on it and leaving droppings. So you install anti-bird spikes made of gold. It's one of those details that sounds made up, but makes perfect engineering sense.
The world's most expensive pigeon deterrent.
The Royal Stoa, the basilica at the southern end of the platform, was a 600-foot-long colonnaded hall modeled directly on Roman civic architecture. This wasn't a temple in the Mesopotamian or Egyptian mold. This was Herod saying, "We're building something that looks like it belongs in the heart of the Roman Empire." And it worked. Pliny the Elder mentions the temple in his Natural History. Tacitus describes it. For a brief period, Jerusalem had a structure that people across the Mediterranean world knew about and talked about.
Which brings us to the part of the prompt that I find most interesting, the non-Jewish access. Because you hear modern debates about the Temple Mount, and it's all about who's allowed where, who's encroaching, who's violating sacred space. But the Herodian Temple apparently had a whole different philosophy.
The Court of the Gentiles. This was a deliberate, architecturally defined outer courtyard that wrapped around the inner sacred precincts and was explicitly designed for non-Jews. Anyone could enter it. You didn't have to be Jewish. You didn't have to be converting. You could walk in, observe, pray, and offer sacrifices.
That's radically open for an ancient temple. Most sacred sites in the ancient world were either fully public, like a Greek temple where anyone could enter the precinct, or fully restricted, where only priests could go in. A gridded access system with a dedicated space for outsiders is unusual.
It's almost unique for the period. And we have archaeological evidence for how this was enforced. In 1871, archaeologists discovered what's called the Soreg inscription. It's a stone plaque written in Greek and Latin that was mounted on the balustrade separating the court of the Gentiles from the inner courts. The text reads, and I'm quoting, "No foreigner may enter within the balustrade and enclosure around the sanctuary. Whoever is caught will have himself to blame for his ensuing death."
You've been warned. Proceed at your own peril. That's the ancient equivalent of a beware of dog sign with actual teeth.
It's fascinating because it's not saying no foreigners allowed. It's saying foreigners are allowed up to this point and no further. That's a graded access system. Gentiles in the outer court. Jewish women in the next court. Jewish men in the court beyond that. Priests in the sanctuary. And the high priest alone in the Holy of Holies once a year on Yom Kippur.
Everyone gets a place, but the places are not equal.
And that's the nuance that modern debates about the Temple Mount completely miss. The question was never, should non-Jews be present? It was, at what level of proximity should non-Jews participate? The Herodian Temple answered that question with a clear architectural solution.
What did non-Jews actually do there? Were they just tourists gawking at the gold?
Much more than that. The Court of the Gentiles was a bustling space. It functioned as a marketplace. Yes, the famous money changers and animal sellers that show up in the Gospels were operating in this court. But it was also a place of prayer and offering. Non-Jews could bring sacrifices. The Nazirite vow, interestingly, was popular among Gentiles who wanted to participate in temple ritual without converting. They'd offer a sacrifice, shave their heads, and go through a purification process.
You've got a Roman merchant from Alexandria who's in Jerusalem on business, and he can walk up to the temple, enter the outer court, and offer a sacrifice to the God of Israel. That's not what most people picture when they think of the ancient temple.
Josephus records that the Roman general Titus, when he saw the temple burning in 70 CE, reportedly tried to stop his soldiers from destroying it. He supposedly said it was a loss for all humanity, not just the Jews. Now, that might be Josephus being generous to his Roman patron. Josephus had every reason to make Titus look good. But the fact that he could even make that claim tells you something about how the temple was perceived in the wider world.
It was a cosmopolitan religious center, not a closed-off ethnic shrine.
That was entirely by design. Herod was a client king of Rome. He needed to position Jerusalem as a significant city in the Roman world, and a major temple that welcomed visitors from across the empire was part of that strategy. He wasn't just building for the Jews of Judea. He was building for the Jewish diaspora and for curious non-Jews who might bring their trade, their patronage, and their political goodwill.
The temple is soft power.
The temple as soft power. And it worked. Pilgrimage to Jerusalem became a massive economic engine for the city. During the major festivals, Passover, Shavuot, Sukkot, the population of Jerusalem swelled enormously. Josephus throws out a number of 1.1 million people present at the Passover before the siege, which modern historians consider wildly exaggerated. The real number was probably between 100,000 and 300,000 pilgrims. Still enormous for an ancient city.
How does a city of maybe 40,000 permanent residents suddenly absorb 300,000 visitors? The logistics of that are staggering.
It required an entire infrastructure that we don't always think about. Pilgrims stayed in surrounding villages, camped in the valleys around the city, and relied on massive food and water supply chains. The temple economy wasn't just about sacrifices. It was about feeding, housing, and managing enormous crowds several times a year. And many of those pilgrims were diaspora Jews who brought Greek and Roman friends, business partners, and curious neighbors with them. The Court of the Gentiles was designed precisely for those visitors.
Let's talk about some of the other archaeological evidence. You mentioned the Soric inscription. What else has been found?
In 1968, archaeologists excavating near the southern wall of the Temple Mount found what's called the Trumpeting Place inscription. It's a carved stone that marked the spot where a priest would stand and blow the shofar to announce the beginning and end of the Sabbath. The inscription actually says to the place of trumpeting, and this spot was positioned so that the sound would carry across the entire city, including to the non-Jewish residents and visitors.
Even the sound design of the temple was meant to reach beyond its walls.
The Temple Mount Sifting Project. This has been running since 2004, has recovered thousands of artifacts from debris removed from the Temple Mount. Floor tiles from the Herodian courtyard, some of them in geometric patterns that match Roman opus sectile flooring. Coins, arrowheads from the Roman siege, fragments of frescoed plaster. Each piece fills in a little more of the picture. One of my favorite finds is a collection of bullae, clay seal impressions, that were used to seal documents and containers. They give us the names of individuals who were conducting business in and around the temple, and some of those names are clearly Greek and Roman, not Jewish.
The Court of the Gentiles wasn't just a theoretical space. We've got physical evidence of non-Jews doing business there.
The archaeology confirms the texts. What about the first temple? Any archaeological evidence at all? Almost nothing directly from the building itself. The Temple Mount platform has made excavation of the earlier strata extremely difficult, and there are obvious political and religious sensitivities around digging there. We have indirect evidence, storage jars stamped with belonging to the king, administrative seals, the remains of fortifications from the same period. But the actual first temple building? Nothing that's been definitively identified.
Which feeds into the mythologizing. When there's no physical evidence to constrain the imagination, the building grows in the telling.
It grew enormously. By the time you get to later rabbinic literature, the descriptions of the first temple have absorbed a lot of the second temple's grandeur. It's a natural human impulse. You project the glory you know backward onto the predecessor you've lost. There's a famous passage in the Talmud where the rabbis describe Solomon's temple in terms that sound suspiciously like Herod's. Massive courtyards, gleaming gold, vast crowds. It's almost certainly a retrojection.
Let's pull this together. What are the takeaways for how we think about these sites today?
Three things stand out to me. First, the first temple was a modest regional shrine that became legendary through religious narrative. The second temple was a genuine architectural wonder that rivaled the great structures of Rome and Alexandria. They were not the same building, and treating them as interchangeable erases what was revolutionary about Herod's project.
Second, the inclusion of non-Jews in the outer courts was a deliberate theological and political choice. It wasn't an accident of architecture. Herod designed a space that said, "The God of Israel is the God of the whole world, and everyone has a place in approaching him." But those places are not the same.
Third, and this is the one that has real contemporary weight, modern debates about Temple Mount axes almost completely ignore this historical precedent. For most of the Second Temple period, non-Jews were not just tolerated. They were welcomed into the outer precincts. The question isn't, should non-Jews be there? It's how should access be structured in a way that respects the site's sanctity while acknowledging its historical role as a place for all nations.
The Sorek inscription is the perfect symbol of this. It's a barrier, yes, but it's a barrier that says, you are welcome up to this point. That's fundamentally different from a wall that says, keep out entirely.
The fact that the inscription was written in Greek and Latin, not Hebrew, not Aramaic, tells you exactly who it was meant to address. The warnings were for the foreigners, in their own languages. That's not exclusion. That's inclusion with boundaries.
Which brings us to the open question that still haunts Jerusalem. If a third temple were ever built, and I'm not predicting anything, this is purely speculative, would it follow the Herodian model of graded access, or the first temple model of restricted access?
The answer to that question would define the future of the city. The Herodian model says the temple is a house of prayer for all nations, quoting Isaiah there, with a hierarchy of approach. The first temple model, at least as it's been understood in later tradition, says it's exclusively for the people of Israel. Those are two very different visions of what sacred space means.
Meanwhile, the archaeology keeps developing. The Temple Mount sifting project is still going through debris. Every few years, some new find refines our understanding. We're not done learning about what was actually there.
One of the things I find striking is how much the Second Temple borrowed from Roman and Hellenistic architecture while remaining distinctively Jewish in its function. The royal stoa looked like a Roman basilica. The courtyard layout echoed Hellenistic temple complexes. But the actual ritual, the sacrifices, the priestly service, the annual cycle of festivals, was entirely its own thing. It was cultural synthesis without religious compromise.
The architectural equivalent of speaking Greek but thinking in Hebrew.
And it's part of why the temple became famous beyond Judea. It was legible to a Roman visitor. I recognize this colonnade, this layout, this marble. While being unmistakably devoted to a god who had no image, no statue, no representation in the Holy of Holies. That was weird and fascinating to pagan observers.
An empty room at the center of the most expensive building in the region. That's a power move.
Tacitus noted it with a kind of puzzled respect. He wrote that the Jews conceive of one god only, and that with the mind only, and their temple had no image because they considered it a sin to make idols. For a Roman, whose religion was built on statues and images, this was deeply strange. But it also gave the temple a kind of philosophical credibility among educated pagans who were already drifting toward more abstract conceptions of deity. The Stoics and Platonists of the Roman world were increasingly uncomfortable with anthropomorphic gods, and here was an entire nation that had rejected divine images centuries earlier.
The temple wasn't just a building. It was a theological argument made in stone.
The argument was, the God of Israel is universal, but access to him is mediated through a specific covenant with a specific people. The court of the Gentiles embodied that tension. Come pray, offer sacrifice. But know that there's a boundary you cannot cross. It's not rejection, it's a structure of relationship.
That's a more nuanced model of interfaith space than most of what we see in the modern world, honestly.
And I think that's why this history matters beyond just architectural curiosity. When you hear arguments today about who belongs on the Temple Mount, and those arguments get very heated very fast, remembering that the historical temple was designed with a place for everyone, just at different levels of proximity, changes the terms of the debate.
It doesn't resolve the debate, but it reframes it.
The question shifts from, should the other be here, to, what does appropriate access look like for different communities? That's a harder question, but it's a more honest one.
It's a question that's been asked on that hill for at least 2,000 years. We're not the first generation to wrestle with it.
We're definitely not. The Sorag inscription is proof that this exact tension, inclusion versus boundary, welcome versus sanctity, was being negotiated in the first century, and they came up with a physical solution. A stone barrier with a warning carved in two languages. It wasn't subtle, but it was clear.
Clarity has its own kind of hospitality. Everyone knows where they stand.
There's a kind of welcome in knowing the rules. Think about it. If you're a pagan visitor from Damascus or Alexandria, you've probably heard all kinds of rumors about what happens inside the Jerusalem temple. Maybe you've heard that it's a secret cult, or that foreigners who enter are never seen again. The Sorag inscription actually disarms that fear. It tells you exactly what's expected of you and exactly what will happen if you cross the line. There's no ambiguity. You can relax in the space you're given because you know precisely where the boundaries are.
That's a counterintuitive way to think about hospitality, that clear boundaries enable genuine welcome rather than undermining it. But it makes sense. If I'm a guest in someone's home and they say, "Make yourself comfortable," the living room and kitchen are open to you, but please don't go upstairs. I actually feel more at ease than if they just said, "Make yourself at home," with no guidance at all.
That's exactly the dynamic, and it worked on a massive scale. We're talking about thousands of non-Jewish visitors during major festivals, moving through a space that was simultaneously sacred and cosmopolitan, knowing exactly how far they could go. The system functioned for decades without major incident, at least until the tensions that led to the Jewish revolt against Rome.
To wrap this up, the first temple was a modest building that became a legend. The second temple was a wonder of the ancient world that welcomed the ancient world into its outer courts. The engineering gap between them is enormous. The philosophical gap, in terms of how they thought about outsiders, is maybe even larger.
The retaining walls of the second temple are still standing, which is either an engineering lesson or a metaphor, depending on your mood.
The archaeology continues. The questions remain open, and the hill in Jerusalem keeps its secrets close, but not entirely closed.
Which is, when you think about it, exactly how the temple itself was designed.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1920s, researchers at a laboratory in Labrador observed that muon-catalyzed fusion produces a faint but measurable Cherenkov glow in heavy water, a deep blue-violet light visible only in complete darkness. Essentially, subatomic particles creating their own miniature aurora inside a beaker.
Muons make their own mood lighting.
Labrador's contribution to particle physics aesthetics.
This has been my Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, rate us 5 stars and tell a friend who loves ancient architecture, or anyone who's ever wondered what actually stood on that hill. Find us at My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.